When a child disappears, the space she'd occupied is immediately filled with dozens of people. And these people, relatives, friends, police officers, reporters from both TV and print, create a lot of energy and noise, a sense of communal intensity, a fierce and shared dedication to a task. But amid all that noise, nothing is louder than the silence of the missing child. It's a silence that 2.5 to 3 feet tall, and you feel it at your hip, and hear it rising up from the floorboard, shouting to you from corners and crevices, and the emotionless face of a doll left on the floor by the bed. It's a silence that's different than one left at funerals and wakes. The silence of the dead carries with it a sense of finality. It's a silence you know you must get used to. The silence of a missing child is not something you want to get used to. You refuse to accept it, and so it screams at you. The silence of the dead says goodbye. The silence of the missing says, find me.
The growing calls across the nation to defund the police.
To end policing as we know it.
With the mysterious disappearance of four people.
But police found what they called an unusual amount of blood in the family home, though whose blood is unclear.
And the suspect isn't talking.
Guns up, kitty up, wolf back. It's Failure to Stop, your favorite podcast. It's the number one podcast and platform where we entertain and inform first responders, and we annoy and disturb their friends and family. It's Tuesday night, which means it's time for True Crime, which is also your favorite show of your favorite podcast. Folks, I listen to a lot of True Crime podcasts. This is by far the best one. I say that just unequivocally and without any shame. I've listened to a lot of podcasts this week, and they were all terrible compared to mine. Joining me, as always, is my ex-wife, former sheriff's deputy, Kendra Drama. She has killed and jailed many men in the name of justice. I'm Jonathan, 911 dispatcher, active in the field for over 9 years now, which means I have surpassed the national average. And my God, my mileage is high right now. I could barely face tomorrow. Kendra, how are you?
Comparatively, I guess I'm great.
Comparatively. How are things going at your job?
Things are pretty good. I've extracted a lot of organs and an eyeball.
Works at the post office, everyone, so that's really upsetting. Speaking of the post.
Yes.
If you're sending things to Kendra, you could do so at P.O. Box 1060, DeLand, Florida. P.O. Box 1060, DeLand, Florida. That's 32724. 32724 on the Zone Improvement Plan, more commonly known as a zip code by you fucking peasants. Kendra, how is your week going? Did you have an interesting one? Or what is it that you're making up this week to convince us that you're a fully formed, real human being?
Well, something pretty exciting happened. I've been working out a little bit more recently than I normally do. And I was starting to get a little discouraged because I've been plateauing. And I just was looking for a sign to basically get some encouragement as, you know, to show my improvement. But so far, not much. But I will say, on, I think it was Wednesday, I went to work. It was a normal day. I decided I was going to make some yogurt for breakfast. I don't make, just to clarify, I don't make the actual yogurt. I buy the yogurt. And then I put things. John is doing something strange with his hands right now, if you're not watching. I put things in it to flavor it a little bit, like, you know, seeds, maple syrup, things like that.
Seeds?
Seeds. Chia seeds. Oh, seeds.
God, that's got to be just the worst texture ever.
It's great. So I put it in a fancy little glass jar. I'm all excited. Take it to work. I start my day at 4:45. So, you know, by the time I get to the office, I'm pretty hungry. And I put all my stuff away, grab my yogurt, and I'm stirring it, getting ready to eat it. And my spoon goes right through the bottom of it, and the yogurt went everywhere, all over my pants, all over the floor. So the downside is I didn't get to eat my yogurt, but the plus size is...
I was going to say the texture of yogurt with broken glass in it would be exactly the same thing as the fucking chia seed. So I'm kind of surprised you didn't go ahead and eat it. It would increase your glass intake.
I mean, normally I would, but I didn't want to freak
out. You have so many muscles in your abdomen. Don't even tell me that you're allergic to broken glass. You could eat that with no problem.
My abs grind it up into a powder. Like a giant gizzard.
Just sand by the end.
Anyway, that's the most exciting thing that's happened to me this week is my my gains.
Your gains. You know, if you're plateauing, find some way to recruit more muscle. It's lateral to something else. Add in another exercise. You know, I don't know. Sometimes just even changing up your diet, adding something that you're missing, those things can help you break through plateaus. I remember the first time I broke through a plateau and I was able to move from bench pressing over 260 pounds and I was finally able to do it. For years and years and years, I was not able to bench press more than 260. I would just, it would fall down on me and start to strangle me and I'd have to be rescued by other men at the gym, which is a special kind of humiliation. That you've probably never had to deal with,
no.
Feels good when you break through that plateau. Just keep working at it. Don't give up. The show is brought to you by Ghostbed. Go over to Ghostbed. It's a website, ghostbed.com. You can use the offer code Wolfpack there. You can save 40% or more on mattresses, adjustable bed frames, and all kinds of other great things that are designed to help you get a good night's sleep. When I was doing the search engine optimization for this show, it recommended that I call the show the Ghostbed and Factor Meals sponsorship show, that I should just make the show about Ghostbed and Factor Meals. It's because AI analyzed the show as to what part like draws the most attention and what's the coolest part, what has the most flow and which has the most confidence and probably the most true information, and it decided that the ad reads were the best part. So go over to Ghostbed. They're a proud sponsor, Failure to Stop, and they have been since long before I got here. I would appreciate it if you go over there, use the offer Wolfpack. That's just for you out there, listeners. That way they know that Failure to Stop is a good place to advertise, and they will continue to do so. Protecting Kendra specifically from slavery going through the end of 2024 or until whenever her contract is up. And that will also probably some of that money will go to me as well. So we appreciate that. Ghostbed, of course, is the only mattress company that makes all of their mattresses and wares in the United States of America. USA. USA. USA, 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 USA. All right.
I refuse, because every time I try, you get mad at me. I'm not doing it.
Literally never felt emotion towards you in my entire life. Go over there to Ghostbed. Get a good sleep. So good it's scary. If you're a first responder, you need sleep that's going to recharge you and get you ready to go the next day. Speaking of recharging, Factor Meals will give you the nutrition you need. Once you're woken up and you're feeling great from having a great night's sleep, you're going to want to fill your life with things other than glass shards and chia seeds. Factor Meals will bring you better food. You can plan for your life rather than having Kendra cook for you. Delicious meals, chicken parmesan, broccoli, corn, mashed potatoes, whatever it is that you like, Factor Meals probably has it because they have over 300 options. You can go to their website. Select how many you want delivered right to your house, reverse trick-or-treat style each week. You can pop those in the fridge right away if you're hungry, right when the postman gets there. 2 minutes later, you'll have a fresh meal, just like what Kendra used to make, only with no broken glass in it. And you can save the rest of your meal planning throughout the week. Factor Meals, of course, will help you with your meal planning to help you get those gains, bust through plateaus. They can help you with calorie loading or carb loading or protein loading or whatever you need. It's great for planning out your life so you don't have to choose what to eat on a whim, go out at the last second, and make yourself feel insane by battling people at the grocery store who are all engaged in malicious, malignant, psychotic behavior that is bad for you. You can also work on your wellness at the Wellness Company. That's right. Wellness Company is also a sponsor here. Now, you've heard me talk about it before. You can own your wellness, own your health and your freedom, all with the Wellness Company. Get well and stay well with the solutions that have been designed by top doctors. They offer natural supplements like melatonin to help you have bizarre dreams. Immune support, daily essentials for your mind and energy, digestion, metabolism, why you could even eat a spoonful of glass each week. And with medicine that you could get from Wellness Company, you will be A-okay. I am a non-doctor spokesperson, by the way.
Don't tell people they can eat glass.
Don't eat glass. Also, Wellness Company does not recommend you eat glass. They say no to that. Prescription meds, antibiotics. You could stock up before the next emergency. Medical kits, first aid kits, contagion kits. Get a membership over there. Break free from Big Pharma with the Wellness Company. You get 10% off with the offer code Wolfpack. We appreciate them for sponsoring us. All of our stuff is about, all of our sponsors are about improving your life. And of course, you can do that as well with CountyCom. They have everything you need to prepare, explore, and survive. Go to CountyCom, check out their online store. Everything for your everyday carry. Powerful flashlights, utility knives, multi-tools, radios, mechanical watches, compasses, lighters, fire starter kits. If you need it to survive when you're roughing it, You just don't want to be caught unprepared. Go to County Com and you'll find it there. You can trust them. They've been in business for a long time. They make returns and exchanges easy. They have a good rewards program. You can get special deals on their website. Be the prepared guy. You can do that with County Com. That's all the ad reads. Thank you so much to all of our sponsors who keep the show going, especially County Com, who is paying me only and not Kendra and not Eric. I appreciate you specifically for supporting the show. Kendra, before we break into this episode, which is about a missing child, as I alluded in that beautiful soliloquy before the intro theme, which I also
really made. Impressive. I really enjoyed that.
Thank you. It was by Dennis Lehane. It's the preface to the book Gone Baby Gone.
Okay, well, then I take it back.
Well, you can praise Dennis Lehane or you can praise my delivery. She will not praise anyone now. Okay, sorry.
Don't do that.
We are failure to stop. And we are going to do a big case breakdown. So what we're going to do is we're going to talk about a police case in the news, and then we're going to give you our takes as former law enforcement officers. As you know, Kendra was a former sheriff's deputy somewhere down in America's Wang. I, of course, was a security guard at Target for many years, 2.5. So here's where I have any credulity at all. I did carry a firearm as a correctional officer, and I did go through no-shoot drills, and I know when I can shoot someone legally. It hasn't come up a lot since I've been a 911 dispatcher, although I will tell you that people do dial 911 when there's a burglary in progress, and they will ask me when they can shoot someone. Mm-hmm. And then you have to remember, I cannot see anything. I don't know any of the foregoing. I'm not there right now. So I've literally said over the phone, it's a totality of the circumstances, whether you can or can't do it. And I can't give you the advice on whether to shoot or not. You know, sometimes you'll hear 911 calls and, you know, the 911 dispatcher out in California will be telling the caller to make sure they put their gun away and don't get a gun and don't defend yourself and all this. I think it was on the Sandra Bullock call or something. And I generally don't tell people to put down their guns and don't defend themselves. I tell them when the police come to the door, it would be helpful to not have a firearm in their hand, because I tell them straight up, like, listen, the police are very freaked out right now, and it would be really helpful if you didn't add to the stress of their situation. But because they have never seen your beautiful face before. So when they open the door, they don't know if you're the suspect or the caller or what. They're just going to notice that gun. And anyway, they start blasting, you know, like
they're actually crying and screaming on the way.
They're crying and screaming. That's what the siren is for, is actually so you can't hear them crying. Little known police fact. Yeah. So that's what you get here at Failure to Stop. You get the inside scoop on what's really going on with police. I will say for the record that police are very sensitive. And they don't like it when you...
I can agree with that. They get angry very easily. Not angry, but...
They don't like it when civilians tell them they're wrong. They don't like being wrong. They don't like it when you're not impressed by the badge. When they walk into the office and you're like, what dumb thing did you do this time? Like, they're just like, no, I'm the police of everyone. And you're like, you ain't the police of me, pal. You know, it bothers them. So
I love cops, but I do think that sometimes they do get a little sensitive.
They are sensitive. Authority. Yeah, it's a very thin veneer. Once you break through under that and you just show that you're not impressed by them, it all comes crumbling down. They're just like men, you know, with our fragile egos that we, you know, we're aloof, you know, because that's what drives women wild. But as soon as we find out that maybe, you know, we're not all that we're cracked up to be, we crumble. So I feel like we're just back in counseling.
Are you again, okay?
Kendra. I'm hurting. So why don't we break down this case? This is a case that just came out. It's from Stockton PD. 911 call came in from a child. Apparently there's a house with a bunch of kids in it. And I've never done a show in which we break down 911 calls before. So we're going to go ahead and skip past that because I don't even know what to do with that. And then we're just going to go straight to the cop stuff because that's what people really like. They don't really like hearing what I think.
And we are going to get to our true crime case. Sorry to interrupt you, but I don't want people to mistake this for this is a true crime show. We're going to get to it, but we felt it was important to address this first. So
we may not get to the missing girl. I don't know. Well, you're about to get activated. You're about to go full auto Kendra, which is something I appreciate. Let's go to the body cam footage, Kendra, and then we'll break down whether or not you think this was a good shoot. Or there was some sort of problem here. I'm going to go ahead and play this on the main screen.
Okay.
So you're going to be apartment. hands. Hey! Show me! Oh, Sit down!
Show me my
head! Get on the ground!
Show me my head!
Get on the ground! Get on the ground!
Show me my head!
Get on the ground! Get on the ground!
Shoot me in my hand!
22 shots fired! Get on the ground! Get on the ground! Get on the ground!
Do not move!
Get on the ground!
Do not move!
Matt, come over here.
So that was a horror show beyond comparison. First, I want to say that thanks to Police Law News and Daniel Carr, who runs that page. He's a friend of mine. He's appeared on shows that I do a couple times, and he's a retired Albuquerque police officer detective, and he has a Juris Doctorate. So he's really smart, and he really knows what he's doing. If you're not following police.law.news on Instagram, you're really selling yourself short. Although we have a lot of commentary here from former first responders on failure to stop. He's someone with a long career. He's an expert on use of force. And generally, whenever Daniel weighs in, I'm forced to agree because the guy's got a lot of common sense and he likes to tell the truth. So
yeah, he's awesome.
We love Daniel Carr. In fact, you know, any old time you want to come on the show, Daniel, even though you're not watching this, I appreciate you. Kendra, I wanted to get your take.
Can you do me a favor real quick, though?
Can I zoom it in?
Yes, please. Thank you.
There you go. Yes, was that it?
I keep revealing my secrets, and I'm just...
Kendra's set literally like comes to an end slightly behind her. It drives her nuts.
Yeah.
Someday she'll get a fully engaged set. She's at like a dining room table right now. That's all the more reason to send money in stealth-addressed stomped envelopes to 10 P.O. Box 1060, Glenn, Florida. So a lot of people are saying that the police officer who's responding to an emergency situation, first of all, he's walking up to the door. He's been told somebody's been stabbed. So the gun's out the moment he gets up to the car. The door's there. The door appears locked. He can hear someone calling for help inside based on what he's already heard. He has every reason to kick open the door. He makes an attempt to open it. It doesn't appear to be unlocked. The door's it then opens. He sees a man stick his arm outside. And the arm is covered in blood. This is truly a bloodbath in the most literal and non-metaphorical sense. I know that lately we are confused about what a bloodbath actually is and is not. This is a genuine bloodbath. And so the officer opens the door and sees two people scuffling, a man and a woman. They're on the floor. It's very difficult to see what's going on because there really is so much blood. This is a knife fight of the old kind. Kendra and I used to have every single Saturday night before we'd go off to the hospital for our weekly transfusions. You could tell these people subsist on a diet of water and baby aspirin because there is a lot of blood all over the place. But when he kicks open the door, first of all, it takes a second for anyone to figure out what the hell you're looking at because there's so much blood all over the place. With domestics, it's always hard because you don't know if it's mutual combat, which person's involved, who's the aggressor. It takes a little bit, and you're in a shoot or no shoot situation because you know a man's armed with a knife, and that's a lethal weapon. So he sees a man, and he's not armed. He has both his hands up, and at first, when the officer is telling him to comply with him, he kind of puts his hands in the air for a second. He kicks the knife with his foot. The knife skitters across the floor like a WB primetime drama, and then he reaches down and grabs it. He's begging the police officer to shoot it because he doesn't want to be held responsible or be paying consequences for stabbing this woman. He wants just the easy way out, which is to be killed right in front of her and the children. There's at least 5 children in the home. The officer's giving commands, making excellent decisions, seeing that this man's not armed. He could still be safely taken into custody if he just gets down on the ground and puts his hands behind his back or felony stop, what have you. And so some people are criticizing him as hesitating when I think he just did an excellent job on a shoot, no shoot drill. He waited until the man grabbed the knife and then refused to drop it, which he could have just shot him as soon as he grabbed the knife, but he still waited for him to refuse to drop it. The victim crawls out. She's covered in blood, almost creating, at certain points, she's sort of in the way of the shot, which is bad. But finally, he has to discharge his weapon 3 or 4 times. The sound of the gunshot's going to make sure that this YouTube video never gets any amount of likes. I'm going to have to go in and edit it later and replace those gunshot sounds with the sound of a duck call in order for us to be a more popular video. But Kendra is a former law enforcement officer and is someone who has blown many, many men to hell in the name of the law. I wanted to get your take on this. Go ahead.
Well, when I first watched the video, because I had a lot of people, I saw it on Daniel's channel, and I really, when I first watched it, I didn't even see it. I didn't see the knife until the officer pretty much shot. And you broke it down pretty well, scene by scene. But what makes me upset is people have been asking me what my opinion is on it. I don't know why, but I've had it sent to me a couple times and people are asking me what I think about it.
It's because you're a former police officer and you have a good head on your shoulders.
But with what?
You have a good head on your shoulders.
Oh, thank you.
No one asks me what I think about police things because I say bonker stuff all the time.
Well, I do have a different perspective. I know a lot of people are upset, including other law enforcement officers are upset because he took too long to shoot. And I feel like this opinion comes from a place of anger, because when you see a scene like that, it's extremely angering. Like you and I know, because we have seen the video, we know the case, we know how it started and how it ended. That's not a luxury that law enforcement has when they're in the middle of handling a scene like that. So it's almost like watching a movie, right? It's like watching a horror movie for us, because we have the conclusion, we see it all the way through. And I feel like when people get angry right off the bat, it's the same effect as when you're watching a horror movie and you're like, don't go in the basement, because you know what's going to happen, right? So it's easy to say, like, you know, fuck that guy, shoot his ass. That's your like vitriol reaction to it, because you're mad that this person could be perpetrating this horrible crime on a woman in front of his children. However, when you are a law enforcement officer responding to a scene like that, there's a couple of things going through your mind. First of all, you receive information from dispatch based on a caller's information who may or may not be witnessing it. It could be third party, fourth party, whatever, third hand. That kind of a scene is extremely chaotic, and I think like a couple of people called in about it. So the information that you have is just that. It's just information. Until you get there, you really don't truly know what you're walking into. You really never do.
You have to completely reassess. In some ways, you might be primed to take wrong action if people are telling you that the wrong thing is happening, or callers certainly are histrionic and tend to embellish or be flat out wrong about what's actually happening. As a police officer, you have to take that report in mind as the reason why you're there and the potential danger you're going up against. But as soon as that door opens and it's up to you to pull your pistol or not pull it, you have to completely reevaluate from square one. Nothing that has happened prior to this matters. Now what happens? Does he have the knife in his hand or not? You're going to give commands and he's going to comply or not. And so everything that has gone before that really doesn't matter, because now it's up to you. And in a split second, you have to be in a decision of whether or not you're going to apply lethal force to this guy. Mm-hmm. And let's also take into account the people that say he hesitated. What was the result of that hesitation? A better shoot, to be honest, because it's not like he was continuing to attack the female. If he was stabbing her over and over again, and the officer was pointing a gun at him and not pulling the trigger, I would call that hesitation. I would call that a breach of duty. I would call that clear damages as a result of that negligence or that hesitancy or failure to act. But he gave time to respond. He gave commands to the subject. The subject was not armed for the first few seconds of that encounter.
Yes.
The female crawled away. So what was the result of, even if you wanted to label it hesitancy, which I do not, what was the result of that? Nothing. It didn't cause any additional harm to the victim, giving him those seconds to comply. It gave him a decision about whether or not he would preserve his life through compliance, or whether he would throw it away by being an asshole saying, shoot me in the head, which is exactly the way that he went. And I have to say, I take some pleasure in him begging to be shot, asking to be shot in the head. He gets shot in other parts of his body. And as you can hear him clearly say, ow, because he figures out that being shot really fucking hurts. So I hope that he learns some empathy in that situation, because surely stabbing hurts. So he didn't get exactly what he wanted by being immediately put out of his misery. But that's not hesitancy. And even if it was, what of it? There would have been nothing to gain by immediately shooting him other than jamming yourself up even longer an administrative hearing over whether or not this was a legitimate shot or not. By having time on the body cam footage to see that he has nothing in his hands and he should not be shot, and then giving him commands to surrender and seeing this guy go for the knife and pick up the knife and not drop the knife, you have made it even better. And it has cost nothing to the victim, who is going to be rescued by a second officer who arrives on the scene. So why are we eating this guy's lunch about it?
I don't understand where the, me personally, I don't understand where all of the anger is coming from the way that he responded. Now I think people get angry and that's what they're basing their opinion on, instead of looking at the facts and how it went down. And the point of when he finally opens it, when the door gets open, he can't open it at first because I think she's laying in front of the door. So they can't quite get it open. Door opens. Dude's unarmed. Dude has nothing in his hands. He goes like this with both hands. You can't shoot somebody that isn't armed.
No, you as a police officer can't. If you were to shoot that man, having seen that he sliced up a woman and he has his hands in the air, if you shoot him, that is vengeance. That is revenge right there. It doesn't matter if he killed the entire house full of children and barbecued them on a spit. When you get there, if he gets down on his knees and puts his hand behind his head, you cannot shoot him, no matter how much it might feel good or how much you might want to. That is revenge, and that is not justifiable homicide.
Yes, and there's something else that happens with these body cam things when we review them afterwards, and it's good to I think it's good to review some of it. To a point, it becomes just bullying and bandwagoning, in my opinion. But it's good to review because it gives us for training. If we're looking at it through a training lens, I think it's good to watch camera footage like this, because this is a fucking insane call scene to come to. But I don't know what people were expecting him to do. And the other thing that we have to keep in mind is that body cams do capture everything. And again, it's good for training purposes and to protect the law enforcement officer, in my opinion. But what we don't take into account when we bandwagon is that the officer that's showing up is a human being who has to process what's going on in the moment. And it's not a it's not a digital camera that's picking up everything that is going on in the scene. And if you look inside the house, there's a lot of shit on the floor. There's a lot of things going on. There's blood everywhere. He has to assess the scene, AKA determine the victim, threat assess. And if you are looking at an unarmed man and two bloody people, you don't have a clear threat at this moment, especially not a threat where you can justifiably shoot and kill somebody, use lethal force, right? So when he first kicks in the door, he's giving commands. The guy puts his hands up. The victim is crawling towards him, towards the door. The guy stands up and he kicks what we now know is a knife across the floor. But it took me personally watching that, it took me three times to even see it go across the floor. I didn't know that was a knife. And as soon as the law enforcement officer saw him armed, it took less than 2 seconds for that officer to fire shots. And yes, unfortunately, she got stabbed again. But that is not something that was due to the fact that the cop didn't do his job, in my opinion. Like, he wasn't hesitating. He was threat assessing. And he was trying to ascertain what the fuck was going on. And like you said, I think hesitation would definitely be if he was actively stabbing her, had a gun to her head or something like that. And he could have acted and he didn't. That's hesitation. You can't shoot somebody if they don't. And I'm not inside of his head. So there's a possibility that maybe the cop did see the knife and maybe he was scared and didn't shoot right away. But I think that considering the circumstances and the fact that she also, when he did take the shot, he was literally on top of her.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to also take into account when you're shooting, one of the things they train you on is backdrop. What is behind the person you're shooting at? If there's a house
full of kids,
a house full of kids, or what's around the person you're trying to shoot or the target you're trying to neutralize, what is around this? What is your backdrop? There's a woman who could easily be shot by accident by this law enforcement officer because they're in such close proximity to the assailant. And that's another factor we have to take into consideration. if you could get a shot, you get a shot. But there's been plenty of shootings where officers don't take a shot because there's innocent people directly behind the person that's the target. And just all of these things are not taken into account when your initial reaction is anger. And your anger is being displaced onto the officer because it's like, get him, what are you doing? Oh my God, shoot him, kill him. And your anger should be put on the person who's perpetrating this horrific crime in front of his children. And it just, it really, really boils my blood to hear other law enforcement officers picking this guy apart for something that a lot of them have probably not that scenario, because that's a fucking, that honestly, that's a crazy ass scene. That's a, yeah. That's a scene that a lot of people don't ever get to fucking experience.
Yeah.
But there, these, some of these law enforcement officers who are picking this guy apart, they should know better. And I guarantee you there's been plenty of fucking calls where they've gone to a scene and it haunts them because they wish they would have done something faster, but they couldn't because they were processing what was going on, or they weren't sure, or they hesitated. And again, I think it's good to go over this stuff for training purposes, but I think that this guy did a good job. Maybe he didn't do it as fast as we would have liked him to, but at the end of the day, victim was saved, bad guy was shot.
I think it's unrealistic to demand perfection out of someone in a emergent and evolving situation with stakes that high. The public does it all the time. So my question is to police officers, why are you doing it? But I want to put a pin in that real quick. We are now already in a point in our society where something like this happens, and the first thing we do is let's see the body cam, because I want to know what the officer did wrong. How come there's like no 5-minute preamble to say, like, my God, a man is slashing a woman in front of his kids. Like, what is wrong with our society? What's holy hell? We just automatically give criminals a pass saying, well, criminals are going to criminal, and we don't care or have any words to say about that, or about the victims, by the way, or the kids who saw this like traumatizing thing in their life that's going to warp and change them for the worse for the rest of their lives. We just go straight to criticizing the officer. And I'm going to tell you something else, police officers, as someone who's not a cop, and you're not going to enjoy hearing this from a 911 dispatcher, but I'm just going to tell you, I'm just going to tell you as a human being, as a civilian, the police are monolithic. You will say that's not true. All police officers are different. All departments are different. Look what happened in 2020. You had Derek Chauvin do one bad thing, and all of a sudden the battle cry is across this nation, defund the police. They wanted to defund you for something that Derek Chauvin did. They wanted to hold you accountable and ruin your life because of something that happened in Minneapolis, Minnesota. That's the way that people see the police. They don't see you as sheriff's department. They don't see you as PD. They don't see you as park rangers. You're the cops. So when something wrong happens, it's the cops that need to be defunded. It's the cops who have to be held accountable. It's the cops who are getting away with legally sanctioned murder. It's the cops who wake up every day with bloodlust. It's the cops who are going after people and killing Black people or people of color or whatever. You have to understand, police officers, you are all being seen not only as the face of government in general, but you're all being seen as the same. The public, the media, and the politicians are all going to go after you, and they're all going to completely criticize you for incidents like this. They're going to use you for political clout. They're going to criticize you because it's the popular thing to do. And in their ignorance, the public is going to say that they could do a better job than you could, despite not having any of your training or understanding of the law or any of the statutes or any of the legal precedents which govern your job or your department policy, no less. But here's the thing. When you go out and criticize each other, you're just dogging on each other and you're making your own self look bad. If you see a police officer that's doing something that you just can't abide, you don't see yourself as ever behaving so poorly, I'm just going to let you know right now, you never know when the day is coming that your face is going to be the one that's on CNN. You never know the day the action or inaction that you take is going to be broken down on some YouTube show, and someone's going to call you a buffoon or something inadequate or whatever. And you're going to be doing the best that you can in that situation. And all of a sudden you're going to be the reason why the third precinct gets burned down, or you're going to be the reason why 10,000 memes are made, or why people are changing their social media handles just in order to make fun of you more effectively for their own clout, to build up their own likes, their own subscribes. at the sacrifice of you, you're going to go out there and have something terrible happen, and your life's going to be ruined. Your life's going to be destroyed, and none of these police officers are going to care about you. So I encourage you to have a little bit of empathy for police officers in bad situations. Just say like, oh man, what an awful time. I feel bad for that cop that had to be put in that situation. He did okay. Maybe he could have done better, but the idea that you think that you could do better in that situation is because you wanted the situation to come out differently. It's a special kind of, it's a special kind of hatred that comes out of grief over situations. You feel like you're better than someone else, that you could have handled the situation better. 911 dispatchers actually go through this all the time. When we see a bad outcome of a call, we immediately say, if I had been the one working the console that day, that would have turned out differently. And that's not true. We all do the best that we can in every single situation. Yes, some cops are better trained than others, but we respond to situations the best that we can, and we do the best that we can in that moment. And my last point on this is that if you cannot find anything supportive or empathetic to say, if all you can say is something negative or critical, you might owe it to that police officer a little professional courtesy to simply not say anything at all. Why? Because once again, we the public see you as monolithic. You are all the cops to us. And if even cops are criticizing you, you all look bad.
It's a pass for everyone to just wail on this guy. If it's like, well, if dad said no, or if dad said yes and mom said no, well, I get to do it anyway because dad said yes. It's the same concept. If you're not a united front, I'm not saying agree with everything that every cop should do. And I'm not saying we should shy away from, again, taking points away for a training purpose or to better ourselves, or hey, as an example of what not to do. But when it crosses the line into simply just spouting shit off for clout and to make yourself look better, to deflect from your own inadequacies, which is why people do that, it strikes to the heart of them, and it gives them an out to cover up their own insecurities if they can jump on someone else's shit like that.
That is exactly what it is. That's whenever you see someone in an agency and they spread negativity around and they throw people under the bus and they shit on other people, it's because they want negative attention deflected away from them. It's always been the case. It's how it is in corrections. It's how it is in 911. I imagine it's very much the same thing in police, that if you have some kind of problem and you need someone else to be a lightning rod of negativity in your own department or in your agency or in the police world in general, you're those bad people, those people that shouldn't be police officers, they're the ones who are going out and very, very obviously throwing other people under the bus. And it's really a shame. It's funny because the public sees police as all kind of covering each other's ass. This thin blue line thing doesn't exist at all. Cops absolutely eat each other's lunch. They throw each other overboard all the time. And it really makes me sad. And the reason for that is, like I said, you just never know. You're 8 or 12 hours away from being the next face on CNN that's getting exploited and used as the justification for riots or defunding or whatever else. You really do walk the razor's edge in this job. You have no idea what the next call for service or 911 call is going to be. You don't know what's going to happen the next time you turn a corner on your beat. You may be put into that situation where you're having to choose between two terrible options, and you'll choose the least terrible. And no one will back you up for it, let alone your own police officers, fellow police officers who would do no better in your same situation. So that's all I have to say about that, Kendra. This is True Crime Tuesday. I don't know if you want to get off of Friday and go towards Tuesday, but we have a case that's been brought to us by one of our listeners. Which listener is that? Isn't it Ben?
Ben Allen.
Ben Allen. We're going to dox you, Ben. What was his address?
That's what that's what his handle is on here. Oh, so I feel comfortable
Ben
saying
it. Allen.
Ben Allen from somewhere.
He always says howdy from Maine. So I think this is a case local to him because this case comes from Maine. The great state of Maine. This happened back in 2011. I've been jabbering for a bit. Why don't you tell me what you know about it? And then I'll tear you down because you and I are both true crime podcasters, and I think I could do a better job than you.
Yeah, I'll probably say the wrong thing or make a really bad decision here in a second for you too.
Probably. But it'll make the show look better, right?
Yeah, exactly. All for views and likes. This case is the case of Ayla Reynolds, who is a 20-month-old, well, not anymore, missing child. I just mean If she's alive, she's older now.
She's almost 14 if she's still alive.
That's what I meant, John.
It's possible she's still alive. It's possible.
Ayla Reynolds. Now, oh my God, you've thrown me off. She went missing, as you said, in December of 2011 from her bed. She was staying at her father's house, Justin DePico.
How did she get there, though? There's a little bit of background, though.
Yes, I'm getting there.
sorry.
So Ayla's mother and father are not together. Her mother, Trista Reynolds, they separated when she was still pregnant, I believe.
Yeah. And they I don't think they were ever even really together. That was just a product of animal lust. And who could have seen something bad coming out of that? Keep going.
Well, Trista and Justin were not together at the time that Ayla was born. And Trista was kind of, she had Ayla, but she started going through some personal issues, which ended up being a substance abuse issues. And she checked herself into rehab. So the courts ultimately granted custody to Justin while she was going through this, this recovery. At some point, obviously, at the time that Ayla went missing, she was out of rehab. But I guess she wasn't really visiting Ayla much. Like, it was kind of, there was a lot of animosity there. It was just kind of a hot mess, to be honest with you. We see this a lot. Well, I've seen it a lot. You've seen the aftermath of it when people go to jail.
Well, I have to talk to these people on the phone. You think I'm not taking calls from both halves saying, you know, child custody disputes every single Sunday night. Somebody's calling up saying they're refusing to turn it over. And, you know, we've got a court arrangement saying that I'm supposed to take custody of the child on Monday. And they want the police to go to that person's house and abduct the child away from the parent. And it's just like, you have to explain to them, okay, so you need to tell your lawyer that they're not abiding by the agreement. And then you guys need to go to court and tell the judge that this is a child custody issue. We don't automatically assume that it's criminal straight away unless there's some sort of like clear abduction, attempt to leave the state with the kid. There has to be some sort of aggravating circumstances there. Otherwise, it's just parents not getting along. And it happens every single day, but particularly every week whenever custody changes over. And and the he said, she said aspect of it, you know, something that was an aspect of this case is that so the mother, of course, she's got some issues going on with alcohol abuse. Trista Reynolds does, to the point where she's trying to get herself into treatment. And the kid goes off and stays with Trista's mother. This is very, very, very common on phone calls to me, to the police, when people want intervention. The father finds out through social media, through people talking, whatever, that and if the court arrangement is thus, or they just feel like it should be this way, that if mom can't take care of the kid, dad should be taking care of it. Shouldn't be grandma. So if the father, and never mind the fact that he's probably been drinking, he's probably been partying, and he's not at all fit to be, or not even have the mindset to be a dad tonight. He's just mad. He's not getting along with mom. They're mad at each other. The child is a pawn in their sick, ongoing games of power that they're constantly trying to exert over each other. This very common with custody. There's people probably in our audience who probably, frankly, guilty of it. Anytime there's a child involved in a breakup, you know, you're forever associated with this person that doesn't have a basic level of respect for you because you're not together, you never were, you're not married or anything like that, and you're using the child as a pawn, as I said. So he wants to upset her and ruin her life and make her mad by saying, well, you know, you're not a fit mom and you're going off to treatment, and the kid's staying with grandma. Well, the kid ought to be with dad, and so he arranged to take custody through the state temporarily, that he would have custody because the state views this, and Kendra, I'll take your take on this, that if mom can't take care of it, you know, dad should have the next at bat when it comes to custody. Many states are different. A lot of states tend to favor the mom. Mom obviously has problems here. We'll get to what Justin's problems are, because the end result of this case is very much a problem that both of them are terrible people, and the innocent child was caught between them.
Yeah.
But she goes off to treatment. He takes custody of the child, and then there's no formal arrangement in place. So when she's just mad that he's exerting his rights as a natural father when nothing is in place, she starts a petition filing for full custody of the child, which may be the right thing to do because Justin, you know, is not necessarily a good person. But Justin gets word that he may forever lose all custody and rights to his daughter. And this can bother him in two ways. As a loving man who loves his daddy's little princess and may never see her again, or as just a jerk that feels like, well, you're not going to take away what's mine, whether that's a human child, a dog, or a Civil War chest full of bees. You're just not going to exert this power over me. And so that's kind of the dynamic that we're going into when little Ayla Reynolds goes and stays over at dad's house, Kendra.
Yeah, I agree. I think that it's a power struggle between mom and dad that we've seen over and over. And everything gets exacerbated when there's a substance abuse involved because people are not in their right minds and their priorities are a little messed up. So I agree with you that Ayla was caught. I think she's the victim of, unfortunately, like many other children, of two parents that just can't get their shit together, really, honestly. But ultimately, Ayla is at Justin's house on the night that she goes missing.
Which was December 16th, 2011. She was just 19 months old when that happened. Mm-hmm. Late December 16th or early the morning of the 17th.
Yeah, they Justin, the people in the house are Justin, his sister Alicia, and his then girlfriend, Courtney. I don't think his mother was there at the time, but it was her house.
Well, there's some disagreements about whether or not you call Justin and his sister and his girlfriend the adults of the house, but something that came up early in the police investigation was whether or not an even more adulty person was there, meaning I believe Justin's mother. Is that who that person was?
Right.
She initially told police that she was there, which, you know, if she is there, she definitely characterizes the evening as not being a party. She characterizes it as a family get together, certainly helps provide an alibi for everything that went on, but it would come out later that she was not there.
Mm-hmm. The morning of December 17th, Justin wakes up and goes to check on Ayla, and she's not in her crib where he put her to bed the night before. They do the typical thing that you would do. I think we've talked about this before on this podcast, where when your child goes missing, you kind of do like preliminary search of the area, the home anyway, and you call 911 when you can't find your child. So law enforcement comes out and they look everywhere, high and low. Usually when we do this, we find the child under some blankets, under the bed. Maybe they were
very, very often,
and they fell asleep somewhere. It has happened. That's usually the case.
One of the questions we always ask as a 911 dispatcher is, has a complete search been made of the home? And it always incenses people, because by the time they dial 911, they're feeling pretty desperate, pretty helpless, usually pretty scared.
Yeah.
And then they'll do things like search the grounds and find that a cistern is open or something, and then automatically assume the child is inside. All of a sudden, I'm dispatching a technical rescue and assets from very far away to attempt to go down to the cistern or search in these woods or launch a drone into a cornfield to find a kid. And then sure enough, the little kid's asleep under a pile of comforters on the bed.
Yeah.
Very, very common.
And that's probably what the cops responding thought they were going to run into. But they find no sign of Ayla and no sign of anything real suspicious initially. Though Justin says that someone must have broken in and abducted her. There's no signs of forced entry. No sign of a struggle anywhere. She's just gone. So
He makes a couple aborted calls to 911 to report this. I guess a transfer had to take place. His phone kept dying, which is like an excellent way to dial 911, but actually not, you know, have your voice or your story being recorded very early. That's one way that leads are usually generated, or we can find things out. When someone's dialing 911 under false pretenses, they usually will have some sort of, well, this will have to do story for now. And of course, if it's not the truth, it doesn't hold up to any kind of scrutiny. And then later when they change their story, it will always come back from detectives. Well, that's not what you said on the 911 call. And of course, during an emergency 911, it's almost like it almost has the credulity of like, and I don't mean this necessarily in a legal sense, although I guess I do. It almost has the credulity of like an excited utterance or a near death statement that if you're dialing 911 and you're asking for help and it's an emergency, we especially as first responders, we're going to presume, even though we often doubt you, we're going to presume that everything that you're telling us is the truth. We have to act on that information in good faith. And so when we're responding to a call for a missing child, we're going to assume that everything you told us is true, that you woke up, that she's missing, that there's no signs of forced entry. It would eventually be determined that she was definitely not abducted. She's still missing, but not abducted. We're talking about a child, by the way, that's 19 months old. We're talking about a kid that even if she could get outside, and I have seen things. One time at 4 in the morning, I had a small child like outside of my apartment door just crying, and he had wandered away from his own apartment. He was visiting grandma's apartment and he was woke up in the middle of the night. It was disoriented, but it didn't even get out of the building, right? Like he didn't even go outside, much less down the street or fall in a river or get into a big white van. So kids this young, they can get out of the house. It can happen. It's hypothetically possible, but this kid's not going to disappear from city blocks. You know, the movie, The Fugitive, how fast can someone make their way away from, barring injury? Well, they're going to go at about 4 miles an hour. A kid's not going to go 4 miles an hour. So the police showing up, that means if this child is on foot because he's not abducted, they're going to be within hundreds of feet of this house. They just don't have the energy, the stamina, or the desire to go in one direction as fast as they can to get away from the house. They're going to be nearby. They're going to be in the neighborhood. Kendra, what is your experience with looking for recently disappeared very, very young children like this? I'm sure that you've located them nearby right away.
Well, yeah, like I said earlier, most of the time they were just in the house somewhere the parents missed. The few times that I've gone to a missing child where they were outside the home, they were in the backyard somewhere, or the neighbors had them and they couldn't get in touch with mom and dad because mom and dad were freaking the fuck out, right? One time I had a child, I was just driving around in the early morning. I just gotten to work. I was doing my rounds or whatever. And I see a kid about Ayla's age on the side of a house in her diaper, just like walking around, and there's no adults anywhere. And she belonged to the house that she was at. She just got out.
That's something else that's very close by. That's something else that's very important. It does add a layer of difficulty that the child disappeared perhaps, around midnight. You see a kid out anywhere. Do you have any idea how many 911 calls that are generated just by reasonably aged children just playing? Like, I get plenty of calls for kids just being outside and like, yeah, there's some kid outside on a bike. I'm like, so I put in the call for service details, child outside without supervision, possibly having a good time, so that the police know to go and put a stop to that right away. Children are no longer allowed to play outside. But if you see a kid outside, we have taken calls for kids in various states of undress. Someone who's a toddler unaccompanied is going to generate a call. If they turn up somewhere, it's going to generate a call. Like I said, in my own personal case, when that toddler showed up at my house, I immediately called the police. So this child is not only disappeared, but is not in the company of anyone else who is anything other than a bad actor.
Yeah. And later, Justin will say eventually when he speaks about this, that he believes that Ayla is with someone that's close to her, is what he says, which is highly likely because not only were there no leads or anything like that, there was very, very little evidence to suggest that Ayla was even really like, not that she wasn't there, but I mean that there was any foul play. During the investigation and the initial search of the home and all that good stuff, they found some blood in the basement of the home that they later determined was Ayla's. This case also, by the way, the law enforcement is very tight-lipped on some stuff, and they should be. They absolutely should be, because I think they probably have a pretty good idea of what happened, and they're trying not to tip some people off. But the blood that was found in the basement, this piece of evidence in this case gets blown way out of proportion, in my opinion, by podcasters, because it's sensational. Oh my God, there's blood in the basement. Blood and basement are two like spooky words, right? That we,
right.
But
Well, they didn't disseminate this information to the public, meaning there's no pictures out there of this blood to be found. We don't. The mother, when shown the picture of the house and shown the instances of the blood, of course, she says, "Well, it looks like a crime scene to me," which of course she has every interest in saying. But here's the simple facts in terms of what the blood means. You're talking about a kid who probably weighs 35 pounds. If there's significant amounts of blood around the house, at a certain point, you're able to determine, if there's blood smeared like that video we watched. Like if a 35-pound child lost as much blood as we saw in that video, that kid's toast. That's hypovolemia. Yes. The kid's no longer conscious. The kid's obviously not disappeared. But just that amount of blood alone, you would be able to determine that a homicide took place. The blood that we're talking about has got to be trace blood or very small amounts. Now, why is that still a problem? Because there's no reason a 19-month-old should be losing blood at all. I know that a lot of people have said, well, she's lactose intolerant, she's throwing up. Kendra, I guess you're going to have to explain to me as a police officer why vomit could be confused with blood. I think if you're looking at a sample and you swab it and you smell it, you smell bile or acid from a stomach or find traces of milk. You're going to be able to determine very quickly that although there may be blood in this, that it's there's other components here that come from inside a GI tract.
Right.
That we would just be able to recognize as distinct from blood from a wound. Like if someone is cutting you or throwing you or you're sustaining some sort of trauma that's going to cause cuts, lacerations, that blood is going to be very different. The problem is, it's going to be different than stomach contents is what I'm getting at. The problem is that we are finding blood in strange places. I do have a theory. There was blood found on the pull cord to an overhead fan and some other places. Why don't you talk a little bit about where the blood was found?
Well, again, a lot of this information, you might know a little bit more than me, to be honest with you, when it comes to the placement of the blood, because when I was researching this, the only real information about the blood in the home comes from Trista's family, because as you said, the law enforcement never made like a real statement about that. They disclosed some information to the family and the family chose to disclose it to the media. The information that I was reading was law enforcement told them that it was more blood than what a small cut would produce, which is like what you were saying. That's probably a reasonable circumstance in which a 19-month-old would be bleeding in the first place, is a tiny little cut, right? But what the hell does that mean? Right?
Well, it means a couple of things. I think the amount of blood was about a cup, which is a problem because
where is that coming from? Is that coming from law enforcement or the family? Because
it's dubious at best. But here's the thing, regardless of the amount, a child should not be bleeding. Even if there is a child's throwing up, that should be cleaned up by a responsible adult. Correct. There's also a story, and this could be one of those things that gets inserted into the record after the fact, that Ayla at one time had sustained a fracture in her arm during a visit with her father. This is very, very common. I'm not saying it didn't happen because I'm not on the dad's side at all. In fact, he's the number one suspect in my mind, but this is very, very common. In fact, I take calls like this all the time as well. Female half has custody of child returned to her. Her complaints are the child's clothes are soiled. There are mysterious bruises. There are marks. I want a police officer over here to document this, to take pictures of this. I don't want to brush that under the rug, but I will say that like kids live a rough and tumble life. I always had bruises as kids. Because of my bizarre health problems, I have bruises as a child that have not healed to this day. That haunt me and still hurt. So who knows? But as a child, she's 19. She's a toddler. She's running into things. She's falling down. Bruises are okay, or understandable is what I mean. And then a fracture is something that's rather uncommon, I think, for a child of her age. But I think you see where I'm going with this is that the picture is being painted as though she sustained a serious fracture at some point while in Justin's custody. In spite of that, no investigation led to any kind of substantive outcome in terms of him being denied access to her or custody over her. That's why I think it was inserted into the record after the fact, because if there was any kind of suspicion that Ayla was the victim of child abuse, Child Protective Services and law enforcement gets involved right away. Nurses, doctors, this injury was treated. If they have suspicions of child abuse, they're going to contact law enforcement and Child Protective Services all on their own. I take calls from nurses and doctors saying, hey, we got a child in the clinic right now.
Yeah.
And we think that this child might be a victim of child abuse. Mm-hmm. So you got to remember that if she sustained a spiral fracture, I believe it was in her arm, and she was treated by a doctor, the doctor had no reason to believe it was child abuse. But this could have been inserted as after the fact as I told the state that he was dangerous. Right. We'll come to find out that the mother is very litigious. She's trying to make as much out of this as she can because she stands to gain financially, but she's not the only one, of course. Justin, the father, a short time before Kyla disappeared, took out a rather large life insurance policy on a child, which you just have to wonder what the life insurance agent thinks about that. How much money was it? Something like $10,000 or some huge amount. Funerals are expensive, but why are you planning for a funeral for someone who's 19 months old? I mean,
yeah, that's very suspicious.
That sort of thing should definitely like strike you as odd. Now, it's one thing if like your kid is like a spelunker or something, or something they're engaging in some sort of dangerous behavior at 19 months. Very unusual, and you cannot just say, well, you know, Justin was just a really thoughtful guy, really good at planning ahead, just really wanted the child to be, you know, in case the kid dies, he just doesn't want to have to be able to pay for the tiny casket all out of his pocket. That's suspicious. He's copped to the fact that he had that insurance policy. I don't think we know whether or not that insurance policy has paid out. I would think of the insurance company, if there was suspicion of foul play, that they could withhold that payment until that was resolved. Also, yes. You can't pay that out if the child's disappeared. If he's making a claim that the child's disappeared and not dead, he cannot reasonably go and collect that payment. So if he takes out the life insurance policy on the child and then reports the child as missing and not dead, what good does that do him? It would be better to say that the child died as a result of some trauma, car accident, not being buckled in, something. I hate to say that, you know, if you're that bad of a person or a father, you could set up your child for an accident and collect on that. But it doesn't do any good to take out the policy. And then your story is consistently to this day that the child is missing and not dead.
Yeah, because how would you be able to? You wouldn't be able to collect on it if they're not actually dead. So
go ahead. If you're going to mention about Ayla being declared dead at one point.
I wasn't, but I can.
Oh, sorry. I didn't mean to ruin it.
That's okay. I mean, the actual scene and the case and everything, I mean, obviously it's unsolved. She's still missing, but there's really nothing else to it. It's a lot of he said, she said. Law enforcement suspects Justin knows more. The adults in the home know more than what they're saying. He is the number one suspect because she was in his care. He was cooperative with law enforcement. I would say he was cooperative. He took a lie detector test, which of course we know polygraphs aren't super reliable anyway.
He also described his performance as he smoked it. So I don't know what kind of mindset you're in where you're suspected of the death of your child and then you are given the polygraph. Of course, you should feel relieved if you had nothing to do with it and no deception was indicated. But I would not say to another human being, oh, I smoked it, I beat it,
right,
or I did a great job, or I crushed it. I would not say these words. I would just say, like, the result is that they did not find any deception, or the polygraph knows I'm telling the truth. These are the things that I would say. I would not use the words, I smoked it.
Well, one of the things, I mean, if you watch, like, the very few interviews that he does and his demeanor in a lot of the videos he's in and some of
went on the Today Show to even talk about it, and his affect was very flat, which
he's very flat. He's very
hate the criticism of affect a lot, because you see this in a lot, pretty much all true crime cases. Lacey Peterson disappearance with Scott Peterson's one of those ones where they constantly get on Scott Peterson for how he was behaving when Lacey Peterson was missing. And it's just like, even if he had behaved in the opposite way, you would have found a problem with that. And it's just because he's, in retrospect, in hindsight, he's your suspect. He's the guy that you hate. You've made him for this crime. You decided it was him. And so now, through the lens of retrospect, you're going to go back and look at everything that you saw, and you're like, well, we should have known it was him, because look at the way he's responding while Lacey Peterson, his pregnant wife, is still missing. And it's the same thing in this case. You know, Ayla has been declared deceased. We have no reason to believe, really, realistically, that she's alive. She could be, you know, if this is gone, baby gone, then she's just in the custody of a loving police captain who could not have his own child, realizing that both parents are terrible.
He spirited the child away to a cabin somewhere in Western Maine, and it is all as well. if this is the plot of Gone Baby Gone. I don't like judging affect. That said, you know, when he went on the Today Show, he was very flat. He's very unmoved. And in one of the final conferences that they had about it, one of the police captains, who was kind of a badass, but he said, I informed the parents today, both by telephone. I informed the mom that we have no more reason to believe that Ayla's alive. And she's, you know, she thanked me for the call and she understood the situation. And when I called Justin and I told him that, you know, I let him know. And the reporters are all like, well, what was his reaction? And the cop was like, his reaction was no reaction. And yeah. The reporters are like, is that common? And he just said, ask him. It was classic. The cops believe it was him, but the cops can't for whatever reason. In spite of the blood or in spite of the circumstances, they can't make an arrest. And I have to wonder why. And I'm sorry that I'm talking over you a lot in this episode, but I want to ask you as a police officer, Kendra, because a lot of the podcasts I listen to are very anti-cop on this. We know that you do not have to have direct evidence of a crime, of a murder. Circumstantial is enough. I've discussed this on the show before, that if your shower is broken and you hire a plumber and he goes into your bathroom and he's in there for 3 hours and you hear fixing sounds, and when he leaves, your shower works, despite the fact you have no direct evidence of that. You weren't in the room. You didn't see it. You didn't get a recording of him doing it. You didn't test his tools to see if your tub filth is on his tools. You know, you don't have any direct evidence, but the circumstances indicate he fixed your tub. That's enough. So we know that the child was in his custody. The child is gone. We've been able to establish through whatever means there's no abduction. We know the child didn't leave on her own. So we seem to have enough circumstantial evidence to suggest that a homicide of some kind has taken place. We do have direct evidence with the blood. It's apparently not enough to indicate that a 35-pound child is gone. But why is it that we're not able to make an arrest in this case? I know that with Casey Anthony, we had tons of direct evidence, right? We had duct tape on the mouth. We had the fact that the kid was missing for 30 days. We had Casey Anthony going out partying while the daughter was missing. We had the contents of the trunk. We had the smell. We had the detritus left behind by decay. We had internet searches for chloroform. We had all kinds of stuff. And the jury eventually decided, well, you know, we don't know when the child died. We don't know how the child died. We don't know if Casey Anthony was with the child when she died. And despite the fact that we had excellent circumstantial evidence to suggest that Casey Anthony killed her daughter, Kaylee, the jury let her off. Mm-hmm. So I'm just wondering, is the police department looking at a case like this and saying, because we can't say that Justin was with Ayla when she died, or we can't say what the manner and cause of death of Ayla was, that we can't go out there and do this? We have had homicide cases successfully prosecuted in absence of a body. And it just seems like when we're talking about a child that certainly didn't go off on their own, as adults are allowed and able to do, to disappear on their own, why do we not have enough evidence to prosecute this case? I'll let you take over, even though you're a cop and not a lawyer. Go ahead.
Well, I'm sure the cops have a lot more information than what they're letting out. I don't know what was in any of the interviews. Like, I can only think that the reason why an arrest wasn't made is because there were other people in the home and they're all saying the same thing and they all are denying any sort of knowledge, culpability. Nobody's coming out that we know of since then and saying, actually, yeah, I have some information or whatever. Yes, John.
Can you get him in criminal conspiracy? If all the adults were there and they're all aware of it, can't you charge? See, that was another aspect of the case. Is at one point the reporters are asking, have you charged anyone with an obstruction of justice? I'm saying, well, you don't want to do that, because once someone is faced with charges, they're not going to cooperate at all. Their lawyer's going to tell them, don't say anything, because anything that you say can, it will be used against you in furtherance of those obstruction charges. So you don't want to charge them out of turn. At this point, the kid's been missing, like, you know, 14 years or whatever, 12 years. At this point, can you not at least charge some of them with withholding knowledge of a felony? I know that that statute varies by state. We have a statute where I live that if you have knowledge that a felony has taken place and you don't report it, you can be charged with that. I think it's a low felony or something like that. But isn't there any reason why they can't put charges on the various adults that were there, whether it was Justin, his girlfriend, or his sister, in order to get one of them to apply pressure to one of them to get them to flip on the other? I mean, this is classic what cops do. You've applied pressure to dozens of people to get them to wrongfully implicate people. Can't you use it for right this time, Kendra?
Well, without knowing all of the information that law enforcement officers have, I can't really say why they didn't charge somebody. Having blood on the floor isn't necessarily like, it's pretty damning, but I don't think that you have enough to say, you know more and you're obstructing justice, you're being charged. I just don't think that's enough. Just that alone, right? Like if there was a bloody hammer and a bloody carpet in the trash, and there was her DNA under their fingernails or something, things like that, sure. But again, unless there's more information that the cops have that we don't know about, I would imagine that if they had enough, they would use one of those like loophole laws is what I like to call them, just to get somebody, like you said, to apply some pressure. The obstruction is a good one. Knowing about a felony or what's it called? Not harboring a fugitive, but aiding and abetting.
Mm-hmm.
Those are good charges to use to bring somebody in to apply pressure and get some more information. But what information do we have? That's the thing. If all they collected from the scene was blood, which we don't really know how much it was because we're getting this information from the family, right? I mean, we have like some sort of measurement, but it's just an odd, they invested a lot. They being law enforcement, they invested hundreds of thousands of dollars and all kinds of resources. They drained a stream nearby twice. They drained it twice. They put a lot of effort into this investigation. If they had the information to make an arrest, I have full confidence that they would have. I can't imagine that they would have enough information or enough probable cause to make one of these loophole arrests and just not do it. It's possible, but this was the largest and most expensive investigation in Maine's history, aside from one other case, I think. But why? And the FBI was involved. If an arrest could have been made, it would have been made by now. It's been 13 years since she's been missing.
Yeah.
So I really, honestly, to answer your question, I don't think there was enough because I can't imagine why they wouldn't if there was.
What's also interesting about the blood, we're so busy bogged down by the amounts and where it was located, which at one point, like I said, the blood, just so that I'm following up on this, was located on a fan cord hanging from the ceiling. If the child's bloody and she's riding on Papa's shoulder as he walks through the room, that's a reason why the child could brush under the fan cord and there could be some blood on there. It's very unlikely to me that the fan cord was used as a weapon and then reattached to the fan. That seems insane to me.
Yes.
Here's the interesting thing about blood, though. And I hate to go off CSI, but it's like blood usually tells a story. When I was in college and I was learning about blood spatter, there's all kinds of things that you can learn about droplets. If it's arterial spray, you can actually take a drop of blood on the ground and you can tell how tall the person was, what part of their body it came from, how fast that person's moving, what direction they're going. You can learn so much from blood spatter, particularly if you have a lot of it, a cup or more is going to tell a story. Did someone fall and hit their head on a corner of a nightstand? Was someone struck? Was there blood spatter on the wall behind it? Was there cast off on the ceiling of the room? And like you said about blood, it wasn't under their fingernails. It wasn't on a weapon or anything like this. Blood is one of those things, gets everywhere. Blood is very, very hard to clean up. And when blood is cleaned up, there's still traces of it left behind. Once you've got blood in your house, it's really not going anywhere. They're able to find that, particularly in a case that was so exhaustive. They did remove items from the house. They performed thorough searches. I believe they took multiple vehicles from the house to see if the crime scene was actually inside one of those vehicles. We have no idea how exhaustive they were. All I can say is that, they were hard charging this case for months and months and months and months. It was their top priority. We do have federal people involved. We have lots of assets. We have lots of resources and things, and we're still not able to turn up something. There's someone in a state's attorney's office who's looking at all this evidence and says, I can't get an indictment with this. I can't even present this to a grand jury and make them believe that the person that I am pointing a finger at I can't even get an indictment to make them believe that this evidence points to that person. Otherwise, they would go out and get an indictment.
Correct.
But they're not even going that far. And the reason for that is that if the other shoe drops, if something major in the case happens and they've indicted the wrong person, that could be used as by that person as some sort of evidence. You know, like you just all you have to do is say, isn't it true that someone else was already indicted on this? Oh, I guess the cops really have no idea. So I guess we can't believe, you know, there's always a chance that there's always someone else out there that could have done it. Yep. So when you go after someone criminally, when you're going after an indictment, when you're trying to make charges stick, you have to remember things like jeopardy attached. You're not going to get multiple runs at them. If you lose your case, you're going to have very limited rights to appeal. You really do have to get it right. And sometimes it's better to let something lie and hope that somebody will talk. You have to remember there's three adults in that house. You would think at some point one of them would have some compunction and come up with something and say something about what happened, whether, you know, whether they have their own suspicions or there's an amount of time in the night where Justin can't be accounted for because he and Ayla are out of the house or the vehicle. You know, they woke up in the middle of the night because they saw headlights going down the driveway away from the house, something like that, to implicate someone, to be a final piece. I will say about the mom, though, we know that she was struggling with substance abuse problems, heroin, things like that. These are ugly things. Not to say that, like, just because she was involved in those things, she's necessarily a bad person, but there's different levels of cases. So we're talking about how we can't make a criminal case stick. There's two different levels that you can go after someone in terms of wrongful death. The other one is a civil case, a wrongful death suit saying you hold someone responsible for the wrongful death. Classic example is O.J. Simpson. Criminal court, we could not say that he was guilty of killing Nicole Brown Simpson. And it's because the standard for proof there is beyond a reasonable doubt, not beyond all doubt, but beyond a reasonable doubt. They couldn't meet that in the O.J. Simpson case for whatever reason. However, when it came to the civil case and the standard of determining guilt in that case was just preponderance of evidence, meaning we looked at everything and we figure it's more likely than not that O.J. Simpson killed her. They decided that he was guilty of the wrongful death of Nicole Brown Simpson. So mom believes I could possibly sue Justin DiPietro for the wrongful death of my daughter, but I can't do that because she's only declared missing. So it wasn't Justin that had her declared dead so that he could collect on the huge life insurance policy he took out. It was indeed her mother, Trista. She took out the policy so that she could attempt to sue him, in other words, for the wrongful death. Justin has since disappeared like a fart in the wind. He's somewhere out there. We're not exactly sure. Trista tried to have him served with paperwork, meaning a summons to appear in civil court. You know, you've been served. At some point, a civil process server attempted to serve him. We don't know if it was really him or not. He obviously denied the identity. Whenever anyone asks me if I am who I am, I always say no. So that's just me anyway.
How many people are asking you that?
Ever since I started this podcast, more than you might think. But they were never able to serve him. And there was a closing time frame on that. At one point, Trista had taken to social media and saying, hey, I have 5 days left on my case before, you know, we have to find him and serve him if anybody knows anything. Justice for Ayla. You know, I get what you're saying, that at least if you could prove in civil court, you know, preponderance of evidence that Justin was probably responsible for a wrongful death. I guess that's something. I don't call that justice for Kayla or for Ayla, excuse me, because he's going to have to pay something monetarily. He's right. Going to have to give her some money. That's what she's after. Is it justice for Ayla or is it payday for mom? And you know, how cynical do you want to be? Do you want to believe that Trista Reynolds, former user of heroin who had this relationship with him that produced this baby and you know, she's been cooperative, I guess. And the only problem is when you're trying to assess the character of Trista, you automatically compare her to Justin, and he's kind of a bad guy too. So, you know, is she really trying to get justice? Is she trying to get a payday? I don't know. I guess I'll leave that to you. I have no doubt that, you know, even bad people who are after money, they still feel lost. They still feel sadness that their daughter's gone. I believe that the family is genuine about that. I heard grandparents and things like that urging Justin to have a convicted mindset about it, that his role in her disappearance or possible death would eat away at him. I believe if he's truly a bad enough person to kill his daughter, he'll feel nothing about it then and won't now. That he that for somehow it was a burden that was able to be taken off of his shoulders, or a dagger of pain that he could give to Trista that would last her whole life. I believe that he probably feels fine about it, and that he will never, having gotten away with it, he'll never change his mind about that. And whoever are the people are who are surrounding him and keeping their mouths shut, they obviously feel fine about it too.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't get good feelings from either of these people, and I'm not saying that Trista was involved in it. But watching her interact in front of with anyone from the media and with Justin in front of the cameras was very much like watching a really bad episode of Jerry Springer. And I just have a really hard time understanding what parent would be okay with, not only just okay with it, but pushing for their child to be declared legally dead just 6 years after they're missing. I don't understand that. I'm not her. I'm not inside of her mind, but she feels a lot of the emotion that she was expressing and the things that she was doing and saying felt very, very performative. And I don't like that. It kind of makes me think that maybe she, and I'm not going to go as far as to say that she reminds me of Casey Anthony, because I don't believe that she murdered her daughter. I would say that she's exploiting her daughter's misfortune. And to me, that's a sign of, I don't know, some sort of narcissism or something. I think that she enjoys being in the spotlight personally.
I agree.
I think she enjoys the attention and the, oh, you poor thing. And oh, Justin's such a bad guy. And you're the mother of a murdered child. And I think she enjoys it. Another thing that was a little weird, and this is just something to add in. This is not case evidence. This is not anything like that. But during the interviews that Justin and Trista did with the various media outlets that they interviewed with, at one point, Justin says that Trista drove through Waterville, which is where Justin lived and where Ayla was went missing from. And apparently, Trista doesn't live, I don't know how close or how far these places are, but she doesn't live close enough, I suppose, to Waterville where it would have been a common occurrence for her to drive through. And Justin said that she would rarely went to Waterville to visit Ayla. I think she said he said that she went there one time. Well, the morning or the day of her disappearance, Trista was driving through Waterville. Now, I think Justin was trying to insinuate that Trista perhaps had like some sort of abduction, like a parental kidnapping planned. Maybe she didn't do it, but she got someone to do it for her. I think that's what Justin is trying to put out there without actually saying it. He's very closed-lipped when it comes to that. I couldn't tell you why, but to me, if I'm a father and I'm being accused of murdering my child, I'm going to be very vehemently defending myself. I'm not going to be vague about it, but who knows, whatever. I'm not him. And she did say it was brought up to her in another interview, and she said that she was just passing through on the interstate and she didn't even get off the exit. And she, of course, she had to throw in there, oh, I was driving through and I saw the sign and I thought maybe I'll stop and see Ayla today. And then 2 hours later, she gets the phone call that Ayla was missing. It's kind of weird. It is odd. And it kind of made me think that perhaps everyone involved knows something that they're not saying.
I wonder if both parents, Justin and Trista, are creating reasonable doubt for each other, that because they both stand to gain from the disappearance or death of Ayla one way or the other, that you charge one, all the defense attorney has to do is get up there and say, well, you know, if they charge they charge Trista, you know, they say, well, the kid was in the custody of the father the night this happened. Right. So, and you know, what loving mother would do this? And if they charge Justin, like, well, you know, that Trista was worried, you know, that he wasn't taking care of her, that she was being injured. And right. she wanted to abduct Ayla so that he wouldn't be able to fight custody or whatever. Like there's always some, argument, no matter how convoluted, that you can put in front of a jury, and all you have to do is muddy the water. You don't have to get anyone to believe your theory. You just have to say, well, it could be that. And if that's enough to convince one person that it's reasonable doubt, then that's enough. And it could just be that that they don't have enough to go either way with prosecuting one person.
Right. Yeah, this case is very, I've heard about it before Ben suggested it, but reading it and really looking into it, it's very, very odd. I feel for the law enforcement officers who are still tirelessly working this case. It is very active. It's still an open investigation. I mean, this wasn't that long ago. It was like 13 years ago. And there aren't any new developments. The family, Trista's family, has filed an extended or another lawsuit, or they're adding to the lawsuit, saying that there's information now that implicates Justin Moore. And this is where I think the measurement of the blood comes in. I still don't, I know where I'm hung up on that, because I really feel like that would explain a lot more. Because if we're talking, like, if it really is a crime scene, looks like a crime scene, I feel like that would definitely be maybe enough for circumstantial, like an arrest, like we were talking about earlier.
Yeah.
Or is it old blood? Was it old blood? Was it fresh blood? Was it mixed with other body fluids? What, like, what? Yeah.
Was it attempted? Was there evidence that they attempted to clean it up? You know, even that could be huge. You know, was it just blood that was there, or did they try to make it disappear? Because that's evidence of some kind of criminal intent. You know, if it was hurriedly cleaned up, if it was under a bunch of bleach or something like that.
Well, that was in the documents as well, that there were attempts that were made to clean up the blood. But again, it's like, is this blood from the night of? Do law enforcement think that it's from the night of? And if that's the case and it was being cleaned up, or is it such as, like, the vagueness of it's more than what a small cut would make? Well, that doesn't,
I really know that means nothing, because it's like you could get a head wound and bleed a lot more than you would, like, cutting your finger, you know?
And if that's the case and blood gets on the floor, then of course they're going to try to clean it up, because anybody would.
Yeah.
Doesn't mean that you're covering up a murder. If it's like buckets of blood that you're trying to poke, then yes.
If it's a huge amount and it's on the wall and there, and you put up the luminol and you can see like rub marks or something, like, that's obvious. Yes. But
we don't know that. So this case is very, like, suspicious. There's a lot of people that believe she's still alive. Personally, I don't believe she's alive.
I think she's out there and she doesn't know that she's Ayla Reynolds.
I mean, that's very, very possible. It could be another Madeline McCann incident, which that's a whole other can of worms. But that's
all I could say is that Ayla's DNA is now in the database. So if she ever commits a felony or something, we'll be able to identify her. So,
yep. So, I mean, this is a good case as far as unsolved cases go, because there's still a lot of potential for new information to come out, and law enforcement does still suspect Justin to be involved in some way, shape, or form. So that tells me they have information that they're not releasing to the public. And if you're one of those people who gets upset that law enforcement doesn't give all information that they have, which by now I think most of our audience probably isn't, but if you're listening to this and you are, I just urge you to look at it like this. An active investigation has a lot of moving parts. And if they do believe that the person who did this is close to Ayla, AKA is Justin or someone else that could be close, Justin's already fled the state. He's on the opposite side of the country. He moved as far away as he possibly fucking could within the continental United States. If law enforcement has information that implicates him, but they don't have enough to arrest him on yet because they're developing new things, and they let all of the details out, they could blow the investigation completely, because Justin could commit suicide. He could fly to another country and evade law enforcement altogether. Also, law enforcement doesn't owe the public information when it comes to things like that. I know that some people feel like they do, but they don't.
There's competing interests, right? We as the public, with police having authority over us, and just the general interest in understanding what happened to Ayla is outweighed by the investigative value of keeping certain information a secret. And the fact is that whether she's declared legally dead or not, her disappearance and her murder are not solved. So
correct.
until we are way past that point where it's beyond her lifetime, there's no reason for us to be releasing that information, because the person or persons involved may still be brought to justice. So that's the primary thing that we are still going to be focusing on, not fodder for podcasts or interesting things for you to think about or lurid photos for you to look over or exact amounts of blood to ponder or things like that. That's information for the police department to have. And Kendra, to be honest, it makes me sick that you host a podcast that tries to make commercial value out of a disappearance of a child. I mean, you were selling ghost beds at the beginning of this.
I just can't help it, John. What can I say? I'm a horrible fucking person.
No, what we're doing is we are not making light of these things. It's a terrible thing that happened, but it is something that goes on in the world. We need to understand evil, and to do that, we have to confront it directly and call it out for what it is. And we also need to inform the public about how law enforcement works, because law enforcement does not go out there and stand up for themselves. They can't go out there and say, hey, man, lay off. We're doing the best that we can, because the expectation of the public is always there that they need to resolve everything 100% of the time and do it in short order like they do on TV. But we will say, you know, with what limited experience I have in law enforcement and with the experience that Kendra has in law enforcement, that's our take on it, that there's a reason why they haven't released all the details, and there's a reason why they haven't gone for an indictment. And it's because that indictment would not stick. So unfortunately, the wheels of justice turn slowly. So maybe just be patient. Hopefully we'll figure out what happened to Ayla Reynolds someday.
I feel like they're closing in on it a little bit, just simply because of the stuff that's come out in the new lawsuit, the new documents that are being filed. Something else has broken and they're not talking about it, but I have confidence that no matter which way it is, whether she's alive somewhere or she's been murdered and she's, you know, I think that I get the vibes that they're closing in on something just based on what I've read about this lawsuit. They're hopeful something's going to happen. So,
and when that happens, we will be scrolling our phones anxiously waiting for that to arrive, and we will break the news live right here on Failure to Stop, the number one podcast and platform where we entertain and inform first responders. Speaking of Failure to Stop, tomorrow is Wednesday. So tomorrow, Deadleg, Anthony, Eric, somebody, they're going to bring you all the news that you need to be informed without depressing the ever-loving Jesus out of you. It's an election year. Everything's terrible. Everything's wrong. Seems like everybody in power is getting away with everything, and that there's no sense in the world anymore, and everything's bonkers and bizarre, and it just ain't the country that you grew up in. Eric will get you through all that. And then on Thursday, we have some kind of sports story. I guess sports is happening. And then Friday, Eric will be back with a big case breakdown, and then we'll circle all back again on Monday with comedy, which everyone enjoys, and then we'll be back here, of course, next Tuesday for another delicious and wonderful case of true crime. Kendra?
Oh, real quick before we go, I mentioned this when you called me the other night. So our audience, some of our audience probably already heard this, but I need to give a little bit of a shout out to a couple of people that reached out to me, and they're very nice individuals. They have a podcast called Movie Professors, and I'm into it. If you enjoy movies and you don't like listening to the same boring takes about the Marvel franchise or the big time horror movies or whatever, check them out. They're on Spotify. It's two friends who just kind of chill. It's very laid back. It's like a buddy podcast. So if you like that, please check them out.
Of course you like buddy podcasts. You're listening to you and me.
Yes. It feels like you're sitting in the room with them having a beer and talking about movies. It's very good. I enjoy it. So if you could just give them a listen. And
Movie Professors?
Yeah. So okay. There you go. That's all I wanted to say on that.
Kendra and I will next week. We'll be moving into the movie segment in which we will be discussing movies in an attempt to destroy them.
We're all right.
Yes, we encourage you to listen to them, but only so that you could sense what it was like for them to still have a show before we destroy them.
Correct.
We're going to leave now. It's an hour and 35 minutes. Guns up.
Okay, we got to go. Bye.
Giddy up. Good night, America.
Good night.